We'll call the next case, 11AP-1044 CR and 11AP-1105 CR, State v. Dale Newman and State v. Leilani Newman. Let me read the lineup and time period that I have to make sure we all are in agreement. Attorney Lichtenstein, representing Ms. Newman, has 12 and a half minutes. Attorney Steve Miller, representing Dale Newman, has 12 and a half minutes. Ms. Whalen, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin, has 30 minutes. Then Mr. Lichtenstein has 5 minutes in rebuttal, and Mr. Miller has 5 minutes in rebuttal. Reed? All right. Counsel, Byron C. Lichtenstein of the Frank Remington Center, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, representing Ms. Newman. Counsel? And you all agreed that you would divide the first two issues between you, Mr. Lichtenstein. What's your issue?
We did, Your Honor. I will be arguing the due process notice issue on behalf of both defendants. Mr. Miller will be arguing the duty issue.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court.
Dale and Leilani Newman prayed over their gravely ill daughter because that is their way of life. They prayed over her because they believed prayer would heal her. They believed prayer was the best thing for her. And their choice of prayer treatment is explicitly endorsed and protected in Wisconsin law. Wisconsin statute contains a broad protection for prayer treatment through conduct that involves the substantial risk of death. And what that means is very serious illness. Even when there is a very serious illness, prayer treatment remains protected. For that reason, prosecuting the Newmans, despite that broad privilege, violated their due process rights. The government essentially told the Newmans prayer treatment is legal up through the substantial risk of death, and then the government turned around and prosecuted them for exercising that same privilege.
Counselor, did they ever know anything about the statute at the time they prayed over this child, or did they pray over her without any knowledge of the statute but based on their faith?
Your Honor, there's no evidence in the record that speaks to their knowledge of the statutory scheme.
Is that a relevant issue, whether they knew the statute?
No, it isn't, Your Honor. The standard here is objective. The question is, would a reasonable prayer-treating parent in the Newman's position have been on notice that using prayer treatment could become criminal despite that very broad statutory protection? And the answer to that is no. No reasonable parent reading these laws would think that the legislature would endorse and encourage prayer treatment all the way through very serious illness and then turn around and criminalize it when prayer treatment failed. No reasonable parent would read this statutory scheme that way. Those are contradictory statutory commands, and the U.S. Supreme Court has made clear that such contradictory commands violate notice principles. The Supreme Court has said in Cox, they have condemned, quote, convicting a citizen for exercising a privilege which the state had clearly told him was available to him. They said in Cardiff, we cannot sanction taking a man by the heels for refusing to grant the permission which this act on its face apparently gave him the right to withhold.
Mr. Lichtenstein, do you think that it's significant that the prayer treatment provision is not in the reckless homicide statute, but rather is in a statute in regard to child abuse?
Not for notices purposes, Your Honor. And I would want to make that very clear. We are not arguing that the exception applies directly to the homicide statute. But the question here is notice. The prayer treatment exception in the child abuse statute makes clear to a prayer-treating parent that they are protected through the substantial risk of death. And the notice problem is, how do they know? If they are protected through the substantial risk of death, how do they know when that prayer treatment becomes illegal?
Is there no limitation in regard to prayer treatment?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I didn't...
Is there no limitation in regard to prayer treatment? Does that mean that they can pray right through death and no problem at all, and if another child is ill, they can do the same thing all over again? Is there no limitation?
I think on the facts of this case, there is a notice problem. I could foresee a scenario where prayer treatment could be criminalized under the reckless homicide statute. And that kind of scenario would involve some sort of traumatic event, a car accident, a gunshot wound, where it's abundantly clear that if medical care is not sought immediately, the child is going to die. But that was not the situation here. This was an admittedly very serious illness, but it was of unknown onset, and it improved during the course of the period when the Newmans were exercising prayer treatment. They saw improvement. They saw the child's breathing regularized. They saw the color improve. It was not obvious that death was so imminent and clear that they had gone beyond the substantial risk of death.
Was the child in a coma for a substantial period of time?
The child was unresponsive for a period of time on the day of death. But as I said, there were other signs, despite that, that the child's condition was improving. And the Newmans viewed that as evidence that the prayer treatment was working. And it's worth noting they weren't the only people who thought the prayer treatment was the right approach here. Various people were in and out of the house that day, praying over the child. People left the house thinking the child was improving and was going to make it because of the prayer treatment. This was not the kind of situation where the likelihood of death was so obvious and imminent that it clearly went beyond the privilege. They were protected all the way through the substantial risk of death.
And the likelihood of death a fact question?
I would think the likelihood of death is a question of fact for the jury. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Help me with this. You and the earlier responses to questions indicated that the standard here is objective. But it seems to me that in the reckless homicide case, there is a scienter requirement in the statute. You know, there is a mental state element. Unlike, perhaps, the child abuse charge, reckless, you know, child abuse charge, 4803, which I don't think you necessarily have a mental state element. So where does this objective standard come into play with regard to the reckless homicide charge that we have before us here today?
Well, Your Honor, when I said there was an objective standard, I was directing that to the Chief's question about the notice issue. The question of whether there was valid notice is an objective standard. Would a reasonable prayer-treating parent in the Newman's position? But you're correct that the reckless homicide statute does have a subjective awareness aspect to it. And in fact, I'm not going to go into detail about the other claims we're raising, but that was a very, very strong defense for the Newmans. If they sincerely believed that prayer treatment was the best way to treat this child, they had a complete defense to a reckless homicide prosecution. And one of our arguments is that that was not fully aired to the jury. But I
would like to ask a question. If there were no child abuse statute on the books with its caveat, and we were only focusing on 940.06, would you have an argument here today?
I don't think we would have a notice argument, but as I just indicated, there would remain a very strong trial-level defense for prayer-treating parents under just the subjective prong of the reckless homicide statute. But I think the direct answer to your question is that the notice argument, which is what I'm here addressing, is rooted in the relationship between the prayer treatment exception in the child abuse statute and the overlap with the reckless homicide statute.
And you'd add in there, I think, the definition of great bodily injury, which includes death and bodily injury.
I would, Your Honor. I think that's essential to our position. The child abuse statute covers great bodily harm, which means substantial risk of death.
It means substantial risk of death. That's how it's defined in 939.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Are there many omission cases under 940.06?
Your Honor, I don't know specifically how many there are. There are not many omission cases, period. It's possible that Mr. Miller will be able to address that better for you because the omission cases are directly relevant to the duty issue. I cannot think of more than one off the top of my head. So no, this is an area that's relatively new territory in Wisconsin. But it's not new territory vis-a-vis the rest of the country. And I think the other state Supreme Court cases that have addressed this issue, those decisions are very, very helpful to your task in deciding this case. Your task is to place Wisconsin's statutory scheme along the continuum of other decisions in prayer treatment cases. And if you look carefully at those cases, the answer about where Wisconsin lies in the continuum is very clear. In Wisconsin, there is complete overlap between the prayer treatment exception and criminal liability under the homicide statute. And furthermore, the prayer treatment exception in Wisconsin is broader than in any of those other state Supreme Court decisions. Despite that, two of the state Supreme Court decisions found notice violations, even though the overlap is not as complete as it is in Wisconsin, and even though the prayer treatment protection is not as broad. The decisions that rejected notice arguments rejected them for the very reason I'm giving, which is that the prayer treatment protection was not broad enough and the overlap between the statutes was not clear enough.
Counsel, I understand your notice argument. You've done a good job of setting it forth here this morning. I note on page 34 of your brief in a footnote, you make passing reference to First Amendment rights. And in light of that, my eye was drawn to Article 1, Section 18 of the Wisconsin Constitution, which reads in pertinent part, "The right of every person to worship Almighty God according to the dictates of conscience shall never be infringed, nor shall any control of or interference with the rights of conscience be permitted." And I wonder if you, in preparing for this, considered the text of that article, and if so, why it doesn't apply here.
Your Honor, we did consider the First Amendment implications of the case. We did not raise that as one of our substantive claims, but that's because the notice arguments and the duty arguments, in our eyes, were so overwhelmingly strong that there was no reason to bring a First Amendment claim into the case. And as you may be aware, there have been First Amendment claims raised in other parts of the country on these same issues. And those claims, to my reading, are not as strong legally as the notice. And I note that my
I know the red light is on. I want to ask one quick question. Is that because the substantive right in Article 1, Section 18, kind of bumps up against or comes in conflict with the state's interest in protecting human life?
Well, that would be true for federal constitutional purposes. That is essentially the analysis under the federal constitution is that there is free exercise rights, but there is also the state's police power. Whether that's true under the Wisconsin Constitution, I think, is not clear. And I certainly think that this court, in its role interpreting the Wisconsin Constitution, can certainly take a close look at that issue. It's not something that I've argued, and I don't pretend to be a scholar on that portion of the Wisconsin Constitution, but certainly it's something worth looking at.
Could I ask one question? With respect to Let's just take this out of a prayer treatment case and move it into a traditional physical abuse of a child case, okay? And there is a defense, a privilege, if you will, that's available under 93945 for parental discipline, right? And the statutes directly address that and authorize the court to instruct on parental discipline defense in terms of the recklessness element of the offense charged. The privilege statute does not contain treatment through prayer as a privilege or a defense in terms of considering recklessness. Do you think the court was correct or incorrect in the way it instructed regarding recklessness? And do you think treatment through prayer is essentially a privilege or defense that otherwise could or should be recognized under 93945?
Well, I have a couple answers to that question, Your Honor. One of them segues really into Mr. Miller's argument. First of all, the question of whether the prayer treatment privilege applies to the reckless homicide statute really isn't before you. The question is there a notice problem, a due process notice problem created by the very broad protection in 94803? So I'm not here arguing to you that the prayer treatment privilege should be extended directly into the reckless homicide statute. That's not my position. My position is that under the facts of this case, there isn't notice to a parent in the Newman's position about when prayer treatment became illegal. Now, as to your jury instruction question, I do strongly believe that the jury was improperly instructed. And the reason for that goes directly to the scope of the prayer treatment privilege, and that's what my co-counsel here is going to address for you in more detail.
Okay, thank you.
It's, as I understand it, and the state can correct it, it's the state's position, or you can interpret the brief as the state's position, that on the Sunday when the child died, the child's condition was such that the parents were put on notice that there was substantial risk of death, unless this child, the substantial risk of death, and not giving medical treatment pushed it into homicide. I mean, there has to be a point when they are put on notice. Your point is they weren't until she died.
If they're on notice that there's a substantial risk of death, they're on notice that they're privileged to use prayer treatment.
That's the point. And that on Sunday, regardless of her condition, they weren't on notice until she stopped breathing. That's, as I understand it, the defense position on the basis of the statutes.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
That's okay. Correct, Your Honor. There's no line between substantial risk of death and death itself.
Thank you, counsel. All right. Mr. Miller, your prime argument relates to the jury instructions relating to duty and the instruction about awareness and religions.
Yeah, I will be primarily focusing on the duty question. The second-degree reckless homicide charge in this case was based on omission. An omission-based prosecution requires the state to prove a known duty to act and a violation of that duty. In this case, there is no dispute that the defendants were treating their daughter through spiritual means. The state's theory of the case is that the defendants violated a duty to provide treatment through conventional medical care. In order to prove the reckless element of this offense, the state had to prove first that the defendants had a duty to provide conventional medical care, second, that they violated that duty, and third, that the violation of that duty created an unreasonable and substantial risk of death or great bodily harm. So the question is, When is a parent compelled by law to provide conventional medical care? When does that duty arise? And my position, the defense's position, is that that question cannot be answered without first taking into account the prayer treatment privilege under 948.036, sub 6. That privilege provides that a person cannot be guilty of child abuse under 948.03 solely because he or she provides a child with treatment by spiritual means through prayer alone for healing in lieu of medical or surgical treatment. So how broad is this privilege? By its own terms, the privilege is coextensive with liability under 948.03. And as Attorney Lichtstein argued, 948.03 covers up to and including a substantial risk of death. Likewise, the spiritual treatment privilege spans up to and including a substantial risk of death. So, by logical necessity, the privilege to use treatment by spiritual means in lieu of medical care negates a duty to provide conventional medical care. You cannot have a privilege to use spiritual treatment in lieu of medical care and at the same time have a duty to provide medical care. The duty...
Counselor, why do you call it a privilege? Under the law, privilege is a very... It's a very structured term, and as I read the statute, I didn't see that word. Why do you call it a privilege?
I thought that was the best way to describe it. It's a defense to the child abuse charge, but it also is telling the parents that this is something you can legally do.
Well, it's what's permitted. I mean, that's what the statute permits.
Right. So it's a legal privilege. I guess I'm not hung up on the terminology, but the fact is that the statute's telling a parent that you can substitute medical care with spiritual treatment under this statute.
That somewhat segues into what I was asking before. Under 939.45, it's labeled privilege, and that though one of the privileges, if you will, is to discipline a child by reasonable means. And the way that factors in is in a variety of statutes, including 948.03, physical abuse of a child, when it comes to recklessness and how a jury is instructed as to whether a parent is acting recklessly.
Right.
Now, prayer is not in the privilege statute, 939.45. Do you think that is because the legislature intended to limit the treatment through prayer privilege or defense to physical abuse of a child under 948.03?
I don't think that is critical to my argument concerning duty. You know, the question here is, what was the duty to provide conventional medical care? When did that duty arise?
Well, in one answer to that question would be, you can treat through prayer, but make sure this child doesn't die.
Well,
because if you cross that threshold, you now are in the homicide statutes where there is no defense to that.
Right.
So go ahead, treat through prayer. If it meets the criteria, it's reasonable. It's not considered physical abuse of a child to have them endure certain things they wouldn't have to endure if they were in a hospital or otherwise treated. But if it gets to the point where a child dies, your religious choice to treat through prayer is trumped by the statute that doesn't provide a privilege or a defense or consideration of that treatment through prayer as to recklessness, as evidenced by the fact that the legislature put it in one section but did not put it in 939.45.
Right.
That's part of my question. I need you to help me with this.
I think I avoid that problem with my argument because what I'm arguing is when the state has to prove a duty to provide medical care, okay, where What is that duty in Wisconsin? When does it arise? And my argument is that you can't talk about a duty to provide medical care and ignore the fact that under 948.03, a parent, whether you want to call it a privilege or is legally entitled to not provide medical care up to and including a substantial risk of death. So how can you have both at the same time?
So then what I hear you saying is you can never charge a parent who treats through prayer with homicide.
The question
is, because there can never be a duty for that parent.
The duty would arise similar to what we're discussing with the notice issue, but it's a different argument. The duty would arise at the point the privilege ends, or the legal, whatever we want to call it, the legal sanction here. When that ends, as long as the parent is able to substitute spiritual treatment, substitute medical care with spiritual treatment, then there cannot at the same time be a duty to provide medical treatment. So if the state's proving a duty here, it has to be in the context of 948.03. We can't ignore that. The statute, as far as, I mean, it would be hard to imagine a better source of duty than a criminal law statute that's dealing with this precise factual scenario. And it's saying there is, essentially it's saying there is no duty to, as long as you're providing spiritual treatment, there is no duty to provide conventional medical care. And so when that ended, then there would be a duty. And I think it would be the same kind of line we're talking about here, is that once we get beyond a substantial risk of death.
So you're saying a parent who treats through prayer can never be charged with homicide?
No, I think they could. I think.
How?
I think
when does that duty start for
that?
Well,
I think it would start when there was evidence of imminent death. Certainly. You know, what would be beyond a substantial risk of death? I mean, we would have to try to imagine that at this point. I don't think we have that under the facts of this case. But I would imagine that an imminent risk of death, if somebody was bleeding, if somebody wasn't breathing, I mean, it was clear that that person needs medical attention right now. That would be, at least in my opinion, beyond a substantial risk of death. And clearly, prayer treatment privilege, or whatever we want to call it, under 948.03 would no longer apply.
Counselor, isn't that what the jury decided? I asked your co-counsel there whether it was a fact question or not a fact question, and the jury had the facts of this case before them. They knew that this child, what was her status. They knew things that showed she was in critical condition. Apparently, she was unresponsive for a period of 12 hours. She had seizures. She did a variety of things. And the jury had all that information. So if it's a fact question, why aren't we relying on the jury's determination that, yes, this child was in imminent danger and the parents had crossed the line?
The jury was instructed that the parents' duty was to, quote, protect their children, to care for them in sickness and in health, period.
Well, no. And one, that was true about one defendant. The other defendant had a slightly different
jury instruction. That's true. That is true. It was slightly longer than the other case.
And the slightly larger one, and I think it was in the woman's case, referred to medical care.
That's correct.
And if I might say, are you going to say that it was a jury verdict, but that the jury was instructed improperly?
Correct.
And that's what I'd like you to focus on. That was the genesis of my fact question to opposing counsel, and now to you. Given what the jury had to find, how were these instructions that were given violative of your client's rights?
Well, first of all, there's absolutely no mention of a duty to provide conventional medical care. There's no standard there for them to decide, okay, was there a duty to provide conventional medical care? When did that, more importantly in this case, when did that duty arise? You know, there's a continuum on the factual circumstances here, and there's at what point in that continuum did the duty to provide conventional medical care arise? And that was never, ever articulated to the jury.
Can you line that duty concern up with the duty not to be negligent? Because the jury is instructed always on a duty to use due care. And they decide whether someone was negligent or not. So here they were instructed on the duty to provide conventional medical care. Is that's the terms? Okay. And how does that line up with what they're asked to do in other cases that aren't quite so involved as this one?
Well, I mean, in a negligence case, you're talking about a reasonable person test.
Okay.
And there is a certain degree of subjectivity that, but there's also a lot of other instructions in the tort law that limit that reasonable juror instruction, especially when you start getting into specific cases. And I think that's exactly what we have here. We have a very specific case where we have treatment by spiritual means, and the question then becomes, especially in light of the sub 6 of 948.03, is when did that duty to provide conventional medical care, not treatment, but conventional medical care, when did that arise? And there's absolutely nothing in this instruction that even hints at that, when that happened.
Well, first, this is not a negligence case.
Right.
This is a reckless case, and that's a different mens rea standard than negligence. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Right. I'm just.
All right. So, one of the factors then is now the instruction, at least, and one of the defendants was that the defendant was aware. In order for the jury to find the defendant guilty, the defendant was aware that his or her conduct created the unreasonable and substantial risk of death or great bodily harm. Was that the instruction?
That was the instruction. But of course, the term create is effectively the result of omission and violation of duty.
Right.
So we're substituting omission and violation of duty for the word create.
Is that your objection to that instruction?
Yes, my objection to the duty instruction is that it didn't instruct as to duty. And how can the state essentially got by without proving either a duty or the violation of that duty?
Well, the duty instruction, at least in one of the cases, was first the defendant caused the death of Madeline Kara Newman. Cause means that the defendant's conduct was a substantial factor in producing the death. Conduct may either by an act or an omission when the defendant has a duty to act. One such duty is the duty of a parent to protect their children, to care for them in sickness and in death, period. And in the woman's case, and to do whatever is necessary for their preservation, including medical attendance if necessary.
Right. That was in Leoni's instruction, which they then paired that back in Dale Newman's case.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we have a very specific circumstance here. And we have a situation where a parent is substituting treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is vital to know, it's vital for my client's liability, for both clients' liability, to understand what the duty was and when it arose. And without a legal definition to that effect, the jury was simply coming up with their own view of it. The state has to prove a known duty to act, and that has to be specific enough that the jury can determine whether it was a violation.
Did trial counsel object to that instruction? And did they propose an instruction that the court was unwilling to give?
Yeah, they did not propose a specific instruction. In this case, the state stipulated at the post-conviction hearing that this issue was preserved. The reason for that was because it was more or less discussed and decided by the trial court in the constitutional notice arguments. If you look at the trial court decision, and especially page 12 and beyond, the judge makes it clear that it's not going to base a standard on 948.03 or anything along those lines, and it's going to base it instead on the Cole case. And so the prosecutors recognized at that point that, you know, it really had been raised and that the judge had made his decision clear and that there really wasn't much point in further litigating it, and they did agree to stipulate to that. And that is very clearly stated in the record. And I would also add that the trial court had no problem with it.
Thank you, counsel. You will have, as does Mr. Lichtenstein, 5 minutes in rebuttal. Maura F.J. Whalen, Assistant Attorney General representing the State of Wisconsin. Counsel?
Please the court. It's important to understand that great bodily harm is not a free-floating concept that pervades the child abuse statute. On the contrary, the term appears in two pertinent subsections. To decide the case, the court must analyze the use of the term great bodily harm in that specific and limited context. And because this is so central to the whole case, I'd like to take 2 or 3 minutes to present that analysis. The Newman's fair notice argument is made from the perspective of a parent who has read the child abuse statute and drawn certain conclusions about how to conduct her behavior. But if the Newmans had read the statute, they could not have reasonably concluded that they could, with impunity, pray over Kara after she had slipped into a coma. On the contrary, the statute told them three things. The prayer immunity, I'll offer that instead of privilege, is limited to child abuse prosecutions. That's the first thing you learn from the statute. Second, the prayer immunity applies to subsection 3A of the child abuse statute, which provides that whoever recklessly causes great bodily harm to a child is guilty of a Class E felony. A plain reading of subsection 3A reveals that, under this subsection, the immunity only protects parents who expose their child to an, quote, unreasonable risk of harm with, quote, conscious disregard of the danger to the child and causes great bodily harm. There is no suggestion under subsection 3A that the immunity protects a parent who exposes her child to an unreasonable and substantial risk of death or great bodily harm, acts with a subjective awareness that she is doing so, and actually causes death is protected by the immunity. Here, the Newmans created more than an unreasonable risk of harm. They created an unreasonable and substantial risk of death or great bodily harm. They did so knowingly, and they caused Kara's death. Any belief that they were protected under subsection 3A was unreasonable. The third and final thing a prayer-treating parent reading the child abuse statute would learn is as follows. The prayer immunity privilege applies to subsection 3C, which provides that whoever recklessly causes bodily harm to a child by conduct which creates a high probability of great bodily harm is guilty of a Class H felony. The prayer immunity applies to that subsection. However, a plain reading of subsection 3C in context reveals that under this subsection, the immunity is limited to causing bodily harm, i.e., physical pain or injury, illness, or any impairment of physical condition. Once the child has gone beyond that threshold, a reasonable parent could not believe that he still enjoyed the immunity under subsection 3C. Kara clearly suffered something more than mere bodily harm once she slipped into a coma. Any belief the Newmans may have had that they were protected under subsection 3C was unreasonable. And, of course, the previous observations about the different mens rea standard and subjective awareness also applies to subsection 3C. So I thank you for your indulgence in letting me set that out. And I can talk about something else, but I'm sure you have questions.
Ms. Whalen, let me ask you a question that's at least troubled me. The immunity section or privilege section, no matter what we call it, talks in terms of the fact that a determination that abuse or neglect has occurred may not be based solely on the fact, and it goes on from there. Does solely in any way relate to the situation that occurred here? What's the significance of the word solely?
I think that the word solely can mean a number of things, the thing it might mean that I focused on here is if you have the child's condition is very aggravated and her life is threatened with death. And the reason I think that that's pertinent here is that there are two cases which I describe, which I cite and quote from in my brief from California and Colorado. In those cases, they were both dealing with statutes where the word solely was used, and they concluded that if you've got prayer treatment plus a child who's on the brink of death, that that this is not that, let's just go back to the language, that the offense is created both by the use of prayer treatment and the child's extreme condition.
Well, those state courts that you referred to both found that solely was important in looking at how this immunity or privilege worked. Is that
right.
Correct?
That's right. That's right.
Now, is there any state statute, and I know both you and the other brief, and I did this myself, do you view any state statute precisely the same as Wisconsin?
No. And I think that that's why, just as counsel did, the court will have to examine all of those and see how you think it lines up. We've obviously see them in the way we see them, but there's nothing that's specifically on point.
Maybe the most that can be said from these cases is that when courts are faced with the concept of a criminal penalty and also faced with an immunity or privilege on prayer treatment, however that's defined, that the cases have gone both ways.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that.
Without knowing specifically what the facts are and what the law is, because you don't have a fact situation that's precisely the same either.
That's right. That's right. But I think of the I think that I reviewed about 7 or 8 cases. I don't remember exactly, and all but 2 of those were decided in favor
State's
of the
favor.
State.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly we must be candid that everything's a little distinguishable and everything's a little helpful, so you have to sort of balance that out.
Well, when you made your opening argument here, you were reading something. Were you reading from your brief?
No, I was reading from analysis I prepared the other day. I do discuss the statutes, the differences in the statutes in my brief, but, you know, this was more...
Is the analysis that you read exactly the same as the analysis that you used in your brief?
I think it is a more precise analysis. It's not inconsistent with the analysis I have in my brief, but I admit, as it often happens when one prepares for oral argument, that sometimes the arguments become clearer. And I think that particularly after I read the reply briefs, and one in particular was just going on and on about great bodily harm, and I felt it was sort of like getting sucked into a funnel cloud, and I felt, well, what we have to do, and what I tried to do in my opening statement, is let's just go back to the language of the child abuse statute and look at how great bodily harm has been used precisely in the child abuse statute. And, you know, I was really just trying to strip down back to basics, and I think that it became much clearer.
Here's what I did in outlining your argument. I'm sorry.
Well, what you said in your opening statement may be perfectly accurate, but I'm not sure I absorbed it all. And it seemed to me to strike a little bit different note from what I understood your brief to be. Now, we're talking about 948.03, mm-hmm. Is that right? Subsection 6.
Well, subsection 6 is the immunity privilege. What I was...
And its impact on 948.03 sub 3 A, B, and C. Is that right?
Well, A and C. I mean, B is not really involved. Okay. But, yeah.
Okay. And I thought I understood your brief to say that because of subsection 6, if we had great bodily harm that resulted from a prayer treatment, that would be immune from prosecution. And I thought I heard you say in your argument now that's not true.
Well, what the statute says and what I said in my brief is the what is immunized is under subsection 3A, if a parent causes great bodily harm, he is immunized under subsection 6, but only applies if his conduct created an unreasonable risk of harm to the child, as opposed to a substantial and unreasonable risk of death or great bodily harm. So it's in the statute, and I have in my brief. I go through A. I don't remember if I skip B, but A and C, and say these are the things that the state must prove. So neither A nor C cover the conduct that exists here, which includes a subjective awareness and the creation of an unreasonable and substantial risk of death or great bodily harm and causes death. A and C are sort of mix and match. And C, if your conduct might cause a substantial risk of death or great bodily harm, but all you actually create is bodily harm, that's covered by the statute. And under A, if you actually cause great bodily harm, but in fact, your conduct really only threatened an unreasonable risk of harm. I mean, there maybe you'd be thinking about sort of an eggshell plaintiff situation. Then that's covered. But the case we have here...
Is your view the law is perfectly clear from
yes.
What your explanation?
I think it's complex, but I think it's clear, and I think that as I... began my opening statement, if what the parent did was read the child abuse statute and read subsection 3A and subsection 3C, that she wouldn't think that, okay, well, even when my child is in a coma, that this immunity is going to protect me. I don't think you could read subsection 3A and subsection 3C and reasonably conclude that. And if you are in a position where you've decided that there's this immunity that can apply to me no matter what situation I am going to put my child in, I think it is, you know, it does behoove you to read the entire statute and not just the part where it says you might have an immunity for child abuse. I mean, I don't say you should then also be expected to read all the other criminal statutes, but if you're going to rely on one part of a statute, you've got to read the whole statute.
I outlined your brief, too. And it's my understanding that the state's position is there'd be no prosecution had the child lived.
I think that is probably correct, yes.
Well, you wouldn't be under the homicide.
Certainly not.
Because you have to have a death.
Right.
So you couldn't prosecute under this.
That's right.
All right.
Yeah.
And my understanding of the state's position is that the homicide statute has no privilege or immunities provision in it. It's flat out.
Definitely. And the defendants agree with that.
They agree. And that it is the state position that under the homicide statute, the state has a more strenuous burden of proof of mens rea, that the mens rea in homicide is higher than, more subjective and a higher risk.
Clearly, which it gives.
Than the mens rea in the child abuse, which is conscious disregard, which in the civil area is higher than negligence, but not as much as intentional. All right. It's my understanding of the state's argument, and so that fits to me your second point. Maybe it doesn't, but that sounds like to me. The next point that I think the state makes is that when the parent becomes aware of the grave risk that this child is going to die, that the prayer immunity or privilege falls out of the case. And that what the legislature has done, according to what I think is the language in your brief, has accommodated religious practice only if the child is not facing death. Once there is a subjective awareness by the parent that the child is facing death, we're no longer into the privilege, even if you say the privilege applies at all to the homicide case. And that it is the state's position that at least on Sunday, the jury could be instructed and the jury could find that the parent was then subjectively aware of the grave risk of death.
Yes.
And if the jury bought that view of the evidence, then this case should be affirmed.
Yes.
And then although the boundary line between grave risk of death and grave risk of substantial harm is cannot be predicted ahead of time. The line is there, and it's up to the trier of fact to determine where that line is once the case is presented. It was, and I think you made this analysis, and you keep nodding your head, so I assume what I'm saying.
I'm agreeing with everything you say.
Well, I'm not saying that that's my position.
Yes.
I'm saying that is, I have to first understand what your position is.
Yeah, no, that's,
And that it doesn't have to be a firm line. And I think one of the analyses in your brief was it's like self-defense is an absolute defense. But if you use excessive force, it's not an absolute defense. And that the actor is not going to know what the jury is going to say is excessive or not until the jury verdict is in. But there is a line between excessive and defense, not firm, but there. And that's sufficient notice. I mean, that's the way I hear the defense. What I'm worried about is, why do you think these jury instructions were okay?
Well, which
had a jury instruction that said you have a religious right to believe whatever you want, but you can't necessarily practice all your religious beliefs. I mean, I'm paraphrasing it. You don't have an instruction that there's a privilege under the law for prayer. faith healing, right? You don't have that. So why you have an instruction, I recognize, for self-awareness, which is the mens rea, but why is that instruction enough?
Well, I'll take that one first. I think that the instruction that both defendants received, that the defendant must have a subjective awareness that her conduct created, et cetera, was sufficient, because we need to remember that in addition to jury instructions, there was trial evidence and there was argument. And this general instruction about subjective awareness allowed all counsel to argue what they believed the evidence showed about subjective awareness. In Mr. Newman's case, the trial counsel, who, by the way, well, it's in my brief, but I believe he agreed with the instruction, under the subjective awareness heading, argued with, in great detail, that because of Mr. Newman's religious beliefs, he lacked the subjective awareness that Kara was going to die as a result of his chosen treatment. Now, the district attorney argued that despite his religious beliefs, he had the subjective awareness that his conduct was creating this danger that led to her death. So the jury was able to, using that general instruction, give a fair hearing to the two positions in the case. And I would just point out that it's my impression from reading jury instruction cases that our courts are loath to give juries these very detailed instructions as opposed to the more general instructions prepared by the jury instruction committee. Because when you get into, well, maybe, you know, look at his religious beliefs, that suggests he didn't really have subjective awareness, that's really getting into an analysis of the evidence. And what jury instructions are supposed to be is a clear and generic statement of the law. It's and the trial court in this case, and I believe it was in Mr. Newman's case, but I'm not sure which one, said that giving that sort of detailed instruction about subjective awareness and the interplay with religious belief would be tantamount to entering a directed verdict. And
well, you say if you believe there was a reasonable prayer help, you must find. That was the language.
And stepping one step back about not giving the jury an instruction on immunity, and this also ties in with the whole omission argument. Once this case went to trial for reckless homicide, this immunity provision in the child abuse statute was totally irrelevant. If the state is wrong on the fair notice argument, and if the Newmans are correct on the fair notice argument, I believe that means that the charge is just dismissed. It doesn't mean that they get a new trial with an instruction that they had this immunity. I don't believe, because their whole theory is that because of the immunity instruction, they didn't know they could be prosecuted for homicide. It's not
that, would be
that it should have been applied to the homicide statute.
That would
I
be
mean, prosecution.
An unconstitutional in application to these defendants.
That's right.
That's why you don't think there would be a new trial. But if it's on a bad jury instruction, you might get a different result.
Correct. But I think that the jury instruction would only be wrong if the prosecution is constitutionally flawed, because if the Constitution doesn't bar them being tried for reckless homicide, then they don't get to get an immunity instruction that doesn't apply to the reckless homicide statute.
Counsel, do you think it makes any difference that sub 6 only exists in 948.03? That's the prayer immunity. Instead of existing within the general defenses to criminal liability in subchapter 3 of chapter 939, which goes from 939.42 through 939.49. I mean, within that section, there are a variety of defenses that apply to a variety of crimes, including self-defense, defense of others, necessity, mistake, privilege, including the privilege regarding discipline right. of a child. Seemingly, because those would apply as a general defense to criminal charges, generally. Mm-hmm. Now you have 948.03, which provides as a defense, I think, treatment through prayer, but it says it is under this section. Do you think there's a reason why the legislature didn't put defense through prayer in the general defenses to overall criminal liability in 939?
Yes, I think the legislature clearly did not put it there because they chose to limit it to protecting prayer-treating parents from child abuse prosecutions. And I think that it underlines what I see as the legislative policy balancing here, which is that the legislature decided to give minority religious views a certain amount of protection from the eyes of others, from the non-prayer-treating community who would look at them and say, your kid had the flu, and in conscious disregard of that, you didn't get medicine and take them to the hospital. And the legislature decided, well, that doesn't seem fair to let these majoritarian views control what people do with their families and with prayer. But we're just going to take it that far. We're not going to give that privilege, as you point out, outside of the child abuse statute, and we're not going to allow it to immunize people who, as here, allowed their child to die. And by the way, about that, I just wanted to point out that it is I believe Mr. Newman uses this idea of imminence and imminent death. And the examples, for example, not until the child stops breathing, which is a little difficult because she's probably dead then and isn't coming back, or a car accident or a gunshot wound. I do not understand, or severe bleeding, if he thinks that those kind of criteria would situations would be beyond the immunity or the privilege, how being in a coma for more than 15 or 18 hours would not be equivalently imminent to death as those things that he named.
Are you finished? I'm sorry. Are you done with that topic? One of the things that raises a concern in my mind is I'm not so sure that the state's argument at closing is the one the state's arguments at closing is then the same arguments that they make here or before the trial court. If you read parts of the state's argument at closing, the state is not saying, hey, the reason we're bringing this prosecution is because she died.
Mm-hmm.
And that they were aware, subjectively aware, in their argument, subjectively aware that she is dying. The state says, okay, let's just forget death, that they are aware of substantial bodily harm, which to me, as I read this, was short of death. That doesn't seem to me to match up with the argument you're making here. And so was the jury confused by the state's arguments, or could they be confused? Or another way of saying state's argument to the jury consistent?
Well, I think that I'm sure you're absolutely right that they were arguing great bodily harm, but that is that was correct under the statute to be arguing great bodily harm, and I have at certain times in my argument focused on the concept of death because I think that that's what brings us into the reckless homicide statute.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But since the reckless homicide statute was constitutionally available to the state and that's what they were prosecuting under it, I suppose I haven't thought about this or asked the assistant district attorney, but he may have felt that saying she was suffering great bodily harm was that they were subjectively aware that they were creating the risk of great bodily harm may have seemed easier to prove. And certainly I think it would be undeniable that a child in a coma is suffering great bodily harm, and there were many other symptoms that were discussed at trial that support the notion of great bodily harm.
I know, but doesn't the state have to prove that there was a subjective awareness of death coming? Prosecuting for death.
Under the recklessness statute, the state has to prove a subjective awareness of great bodily harm or death.
I understand that. And that's why the
death results.
Yeah, and death results. But that's one of the big points that I understand the defendants are making.
Well,
you're talking on the one hand about great bodily harm, and yet the child abuse statute says, well, you've got great bodily harm, but you got a privilege or an immunity. Now, in homicide, you're saying, oh, you don't. That's what their whole point, as I understand it, doesn't mean it's their point. It's conflicting. On the one hand, you give them the privilege. On the other hand, you take it away. What is at stake? That's their point.
Well, I think that we're combining different parts of the arguments. Their discussion of great bodily harm is not a matter of what's being proved at a reckless homicide trial. Their argument about great bodily harm has to do with what were we supposed to think when we read the statutes? And that's what I tried to start out my argument with, is saying if you read about great bodily harm in the child abuse statute, you can't expect it to immunize the conduct that occurred here. Once the circuit court ruled that the state could constitutionally prosecute and try the defendants under the reckless homicide statute, it was up to the district attorney to decide within the parameters of the reckless homicide statute he was going to argue his case. But so there's really just different things. Just as I similarly, the immunity issue is just not relevant once the court decides that the reckless homicide statute it can be constitutionally applied. Could I just make one final remark, because I know I'm over, and I'll try to make it briefly.
Very, very brief.
Yes, but in answer to the question you didn't ask, how should we write this opinion?
ask an a answer. Question than I usually ask. Okay, I'll ask the question.
But on the fair notice issue, obviously I hope you'll agree with the state. But in the event that you don't, I think it's important to tell the citizens of Wisconsin that henceforth there can be no question that the prayer immunity in subsection 6 of the child abuse statute applies only to the child abuse statute. I think that after this case, that fair notice should never be an issue again for the Newmans or anyone else. So that's, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Lixon.
Good
Thank you, Your Honor. A few points. First of all, the state's great bodily harm analysis is a moving target. What we heard today is a brand new analysis of what the great bodily harm statutes mean. As far as I can tell, that's not what the state argued in their brief. And I confess, I didn't entirely understand what their new analysis is, but I know it's different than what they argued in their brief. Our basic point, however, remains the same. And it's pretty simple. Great bodily harm includes the substantial risk of death. The prayer treatment privilege applies to great bodily harm. Therefore, the prayer treatment privilege applies through the substantial risk of death. The state keeps trying to shrink the privilege. That's the point of all these different iterations of their statutory analysis. They keep wanting to make the privilege smaller than the legislature made it. Whether you like the privilege, the immunity, I apologize, Your Honor, whatever we want to call it, whether you like the policy behind the immunity or not, the legislature created it, and it applies to substantial risk of death. It's not the province of the state or this court to make the privilege smaller than the legislature made it. And that's what the state's arguments are an attempt to do here, and this court should not go there. Second, I want to respond to a couple points that Justice Ziegler raised. Your Honor, you made the argument that perhaps what this statutory scheme means is you can treat through prayer, but make sure the child doesn't die. And I think there's a really good response to that line of thinking in U.S. Supreme Court case law. And what notice principles are about, it's about allowing people to be free to steer between lawful and unlawful conduct. And notice is violated when the government forces people to, and this is a quote from Granted, which is 408 U.S. 104, notice is violated when the government forces people to steer far wider of the unlawful zone than if the boundaries of the forbidden areas were clearly marked. And that's what the state's interpretation does here, is it essentially says you've got to swim very, very far away from the boundary. Even though you're protected through substantial risk of death, you really can't get anywhere near that because you're going to be prosecuted for homicide if death occurs. And that violates notice principles. People have the right, when the government has made this conduct legal, which is what they've done here, they've protected it through a very broad, very serious illness. When the government has done that, they can't then turn around and shrink it by prosecuting someone under a different statute that's very, very close. This way of doing things is a trap. It's not a situation where the lines are hazy. It's a trap. Prayer-treating parents are told, you can do this even when the going is really, really tough. But then on the other hand, when prayer fails, they're prosecuted for homicide. That's a trap, and notice principles prohibit that.
So this case was tried. These cases were tried by the prosecution as not creating a risk of... Were they tried with the theory that they created a substantial risk of great bodily harm that resulted in death? Was that the state's theory?
I think that's fair, Your Honor. I also want to return to the point you raised, Justice Ziegler, about the fact that this prayer treatment privilege, prayer treatment immunity, is in the section 948.03 rather than in the section of more general immunities and defenses. And I think that would be relevant if what we were dealing with is a question of legislative intent about whether the prayer treatment provision applied to everything in the criminal code, including homicide. But that isn't what we're dealing with. This is not a question of whether that provision applies directly to homicide. It's a notice question. And as I've tried to make clear, when you have an immunity that extends so very broadly, so very far, through the substantial risk of death, you've got a problem when a person is prosecuted for the fact that death occurs. I see that my light is on.
Counsel, at the beginning of your rebuttal, you said, what I think you said was, great bodily harm includes substantial risk of death. Is that what you said?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
And so, by saying that, did you mean to indicate that any act that causes great bodily harm of necessity or by definition creates a substantial risk of death?
No, I didn't, Your Honor. I think there's an alternative aspect to the definition of great bodily harm. But substantial risk of death is the most serious kind of harm included within the definition of great bodily harm. There could be less serious kinds of harm that fall within that.
Well, my eye is drawn to the distinction between criminal recklessness, the definition of criminal recklessness, and the definition of recklessness in the child abuse statute. And that's what State v. Williams was discussing. Reckless child abuse requires the defendant's actions demonstrate a conscious disregard for the safety of a child, not that the defendant was subjectively aware of that risk. In contrast, criminal recklessness is defined as when the actor creates an unreasonable and substantial risk of death or great bodily harm. Now, that indicates to me that we're talking separate things.
Well, I think this gets a little bit to the discussion that the state was having with Justice Prosser, which is that...
And to be comprehensive, that's why I thought you were trying to hook up great bodily harm to substantial risk of death, because of that distinction. Now I'll be quiet and listen to your response.
I guess I'm not going to tell you anything I haven't already said, I don't think, which is that I think this goes a little bit to the discussion that Justice Prosser had with the state, which is that it's a bit of a mess. I don't deny that, but I think a simple point that I would return to is great bodily harm is the form of harm present in the child abuse statute. Great bodily harm plainly means it goes as far as the substantial risk of death, and the prayer treatment immunity applies to that. Therefore, and this is the simple point that we have stuck to throughout the litigation in this case, the prayer treatment immunity applies through the substantial risk of death. I'm not sure exactly what the state's position is at this point, but that's the simple point that we have stuck with throughout this litigation. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Miller.
Thank you. I just have a couple of quick points. I wanted first to respond to the issue of the word solely in the privilege stat or immunity or whatever we're going to call it in 948.036. It seems to me that the meaning of that word, and when I read the state's explanation of that, I was somewhat taken aback. But I think clearly what the legislature is aiming at there is that they don't want to immunize something other than clearly prayer treatment, and that's really what they're going after there. They don't want somebody to use prayer treatment as a defense in the child abuse statute when it's mixed with something that might have caused harm. And I think what they're trying to say is that, you know, what we're looking at clearly here is where we have a prayer treating parent, and that's the sole basis for the charge. The other thing I think that did not get raised yet, and I wanted to call the court's attention to, is the fact that the state, in their on the duty question, the state in their brief made the statement that the duty here, their response to the question of, okay, what is the duty here? Is that there is, quote, a duty common to all Wisconsin parents to provide their children with the medical treatment necessary to preserve their lives. And I found that quite interesting, and I found that fact very similar to what, in fact, my client is arguing in his brief, in that I'm not sure there's much of a difference between a substantial risk of death and where a privilege goes through that point, or that an affirmative duty arises after that point, or an affirmative duty to provide medical care to preserve the child's life. In fact, were I trial counsel, I would have no objection to that instruction. I think that would be pretty close, and I think that's really what we're looking at here, and I frankly view it almost as a confession of error, because it's not anywhere near what the instruction was in this case. I think if the jury had understood that there was an affirmative duty to provide medical care if it was necessary to preserve the child's life, I think that would have been a perfectly acceptable instruction to the defense.
So, counsel, do you see a distinction between great bodily harm and substantial risk of death?
Substantial risk of death is great bodily harm, as I understand it. I mean, that is part of the definition of great bodily harm.
That's half of the syllogism, but that doesn't mean that doesn't of necessity mean that great bodily harm is always a matter of substantial risk of death.
No, I think we're just talking about the range.
Right, and so wouldn't it be logical, and if not, please tell me, that the legislature would have put the prayer treatment immunity under 948.03, where the standard is causing great bodily harm, and the legislature saying, okay, treatment through prayer, we're willing to accept up to great bodily harm. But once it becomes a substantial risk of death, that's not in 948.03.
I believe that the definition has to be. I mean, the 948.03.
What definition has to be?
940.03 does not define great bodily harm. And so then we need to go to the definition of great bodily harm, you know, in
24.1.
But isn't that what Williams said was the difference? That criminal recklessness requires the great risk of the substantial risk of death.
As I understand it, the difference that was pointed out was the mental state.
Yes.
That it was that in reckless homicide, there is a mental state of awareness of the risk of great bodily harm. Whereas in the child abuse statute, the mental state is conscious disregard for the child. Okay, but then the question is there a difference from a notice standpoint, I think primarily, but is there a difference from a notice standpoint between those two mental states when the result in both cases is a substantial risk of death? Or, you know, because in the child abuse statute, you can have a substantial risk of death as a result and still be covered under the privilege. So then the question becomes, is that how different is that from an awareness of a risk of substantial risk of death? I mean, I guess the question is can you cause a substantial risk of death and not be aware of it?
Yeah, I think
I suppose it's possible, but I think in most cases that we're really starting to split hairs there in terms of notice. Now, we're not doing a double jeopardy analysis here. We're talking about a parent looking at the child abuse statute and understanding, okay, you know, I have a privilege to use spiritual treatment. Legislature's telling me that. Up to and including substantial risk of death.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. I would like to thank all counsel here for their briefs and their arguments here. As counsel knows, but as the court is very well aware, this is a very difficult case. You have parents who are believers in are trying to do the best for their child, and the result of the parents trying to do the best for their child in this particular case resulted in death. And what we have here is that very, very tragic circumstance, not only for the child, but for the parents and for the family, all packaged into complex and dense statutes. As in many cases, the court is left, as you all said, with very difficult legal questions in a very tragic personal event or events. That concludes our hearing in 11AP 1044 CR and 11AP 1105 CR, State versus Dale Newman and State versus Leilani Newman. The